This message is part two of the subject that we began last week, crucifixion of Jesus. Many of the themes that we encountered in verses 17 through 24 will continue. We will see more of the nobility of the divine Son manifested in the most terrible of circumstances. We will receive more support for the truth that this horror and humiliation were necessary elements of a divine plan that was fully accomplished. But there is a definite shift of emphasis in verse 25. Until then, the focus is on what others were doing to Jesus, though their actions were predicted. Jesus did not speak. He simply bore his mistreatment with patience and humility. Now, as the crucifixion nears its climax, Jesus opens his mouth. What will he have to say? He makes three statements that are found only in this gospel. And they form the outline for this message. Now, technically, there were four statements. I understand that. We're going to combine the first two, as most people do. We know that these are not the only words that Jesus delivered from the cross. Again, John is supplementing what we already had. But there are very precious words here that serve to give us further insight into the character and the nature and the complete sufficiency of Christ. Do you want to know who he is? Well, you find out a lot about that in these words. Throughout history, you know, we've attached significance to the last words of an important person. We have the saying, famous last words. Well, these final statements dwarf all others in their impact, and none more so than "it is finished." We begin with verses 25 through 27. Just heard those read. I won't read them aloud. You see them before you. It's easy to understand why John would be sure to include this touching scene in his account. As the disciple whom Jesus loved, he was intimately involved in these arrangements. This is the first time in a long while that we have had any mention of supporters of Jesus being physically present with him. Since the disciples scattered into the night from the Garden of Gethsemane, no one is said to have stood with Jesus until now. Peter definitely denied Jesus. We've seen that. No other disciple besides John is in view until after the resurrection of Christ. The picture we get is that apart from John, the disciples were in hiding, fearing to show their faces lest they be swept up in this mania that was going on now to murder Jesus. And while we cannot condone their desertion of their Lord, I think we can understand it. But John's been around, hasn't he? We know that he was keeping tabs in some way on the trials of Jesus because he got Peter admitted into the courtyard of the high priest. I would love to know what he was doing all along. It's one of those things, you know, you want to meet John and say, "Hey, what was going on and what were you doing and thinking during all this time?" Well, We don't have that. We can only guess. He had some kind of a connection, it seems, with the high priest or those around him, and evidently used it to stay relatively near Jesus. He must have followed the Lord through the streets of Jerusalem to Golgotha. He was willing to stand by the cross in the midst of the mockers. And you think of yourself being there. I mean, it's hard to even choose what would be torturing your soul more in that kind of a situation. But he was there. He was listening. That despite being a known follower of the condemned man, in this he shows both courage and a deep commitment to Jesus. We see a special bond of love that explains the phrase by which John is identified, that disciple whom Jesus loved. That certainly seems to fit that kind of a term. How interesting, though, that all of the others mentioned are women. All of the Gospels emphasize the presence of women at the cross, and in the early morning resurrection scenes. The women really take center stage. And there are apparently many more than those who are listed here. I suppose we could say that they were in less danger than the disciples and other male followers, but still, the loving hearts of the women shine through here. When they were most needed. What an encouragement in distress it must have been to Jesus to see these women surrounding him in his greatest trial. Four women are identified. We have Mary, Jesus' mother. You know her. I'm not going to describe the situation. A little bit to say in a moment. Then we have Jesus' aunt. This was very likely Salome, who was John's mother, the Apostle John's mother. The tie between Jesus and John was probably one of blood as well as friendship. Remember, Salome had asked Jesus to give her sons special places of authority in this coming kingdom. We dealt with that in our kingdom series, and we've dealt with that when we've been through the other Gospels. Remember, I want you to command that they sit on your right and your left in your kingdom. And what did Jesus say? I don't think you really know what you're asking here. Are they ready to drink the cup that I'm about to drink? What was going through Salome's mind now? What was I asking for? What does this mean? What does this mean for my sons? What does this mean for my thoughts about the kingdom? Boy, she had to be going through a lot of soul searching about this. And you think, well, where was James? His brother's there. His mom's there. He doesn't appear to be there. And yet, who would be the first of the disciples to be martyred? James, son of Salome. He would drink the cup. And he will have a very high place in the kingdom. Timing will be a little bit different than Salome was thinking at the time. But these are the kinds of thoughts and issues that are swirling in people's minds here. About Mary, the wife of Clopas, we know next to nothing. And I do want to point out at this point, you've already picked it up, that his mother's sister and then Mary, the wife of Clopas, are two different people from everything that I can discern. It could be read as if there were three women there, and one of them was the mother's sister, whose name was Mary, the wife of Clopas. That's a possible understanding. I'm understanding it as four women. And I'm not going to go into every in and out of that. But this Mary, the wife of Clopas, was probably in that group of women who went to the tomb early Sunday morning. We read in Matthew's gospel of this other Mary, not said to be the wife of Clopas there, but the mother of James and Joseph. And most people consider that to be a reference to James the Less, another of the disciples of Jesus. That's because Clopas is apparently in some way connected to the name Alphaeus, and we know that James the Less's father was Alphaeus. So it's kind of complicated, and for me, the relationship between Clopas and Alphaeus, you know, wouldn't necessarily just jump out to me, but if you get into the etymology, it works that way. So anyway, we think that this is who this third person is, a mother of another one of the disciples who will be sacrificing much in the days to come. Mary Magdalene, she had been delivered from seven demons by Jesus. Big financial supporter of Jesus's ministry, and we will be seeing more about her later. Mary, a popular name, right? You need a scorecard to keep track of them. Well, as Jesus gazes at this group of women, he sees John standing there near his mother. I mean, some of these things you can just emotionally hardly bear to think about, is looking down and seeing them. These were the two people that he most loved in all the world. And he knew that they needed to be brought together. So he tells Mary, in effect, this is now your son. This is now your son. I'm leaving. And to John, this is your mother. Why does he say woman and not mother? We can come up with at least two reasons. One of them might be that hearing the word mother, you know, that could have been too much to bear right then, you know, in this situation. But another thought, Mary needed to look at what Jesus was accomplishing from the right perspective. As at the wedding of Cana, we dealt with that back at the beginning of John. We talked about why he gave her the same kind of an address. Mary had to see Jesus not primarily as a son, flesh and blood son, to be nurtured, but as a Lord to be honored. Someone to be obeyed. Jesus was dying for her sins as well as everyone else's. It's always important when sometimes Mary is made too much of to note these things. But what reaches out and grabs me about these statements is the concern that Jesus shows for others. In the midst of this incredible personal anguish, something we dealt with last time regarding the thieves and just here we are again. It goes back to Jesus taking up the towel and the basin of water in the upper room, and just the other centeredness. He's in tremendous physical pain that we, you know, can't grasp. He's been mocked. He's dreading the weight of sin that's about to come upon him. And what's he thinking about? Mary's need for a man to look after her. Joseph was obviously dead. Don't know when that occurred, but he's gone. Mary had other sons, but they were not believers at this time. What better person was there to leave her with than his cousin and his best friend? But that Jesus' mind would even be pondering such matters, so instructive for us. What's the fleshly tendency when our circumstances become difficult? What happens when we're sick, when we're in pain? We're hurting. You know, you tend to pull into yourself. Our thoughts are more on what others should be doing for us. Okay? Look what I'm dealing with. You're not dealing with that. Come on. Why don't you get outside of yourself? We can be tempted to bail out on our responsibilities. Hey, I'm too tired to discipline my child. I'm too busy to serve the Lord. Things are too tight to give to the Lord. You got to understand. It's tough being me. Jesus' words here are a reminder that our call to love others sacrificially doesn't stop when things get tough for us. And that's especially true when it comes to family. That was the issue here. We need to follow Jesus' example of concern here. We see this teaching in 1 Timothy, right? Telling us about how to take care of our own, taking care of widows. Where is that teaching coming from? That's coming from the Spirit of Christ to us. And Jesus is practicing what he preaches. I know I have this responsibility and this concern, even in the midst of all of this, and I'm going to see to it that I fulfill. Like, oh, he provides for his widowed mother. The next little vignette during the crucifixion is found in verses 28 and 29. After this, Jesus, knowing that all things had already been accomplished, to fulfill the scripture, said, "I am thirsty." A jar full of sour wine was standing there, so they put a sponge full of the sour wine upon a branch of hyssop and brought it up to his mouth. Has something happened between verses 27 and 28? Yes. Something of greatest importance. Something of eternal consequence for all of the elect. We're tipped off by that phrase, had already been accomplished. If all that Jesus has been sent to accomplish, you know, has been done, what has taken place? Jesus has borne the wrath of God against sin. Between the words, "Behold your mother," and "I am thirsty," the most wrenching words of all had been uttered, my God, why hast thou forsaken me?" As Jesus bore the punishment for our sin, the fellowship that he had known with the Father from all eternity was cut off from his human consciousness. The experience was literally pure hell. Understandably, Jesus is now at the brink of death. He has been tortured physically. He has been tormented spiritually. As anyone knows who has studied what goes on a battlefield, wounds bring on a raging thirst. People always crying out for water on a battlefield. Jesus had been scourged, been pinned to a cross for hours, significant loss of blood. And so he makes the simple statement that he is thirsty. This is yet another fulfillment of prophecy we read. Psalm 69:21. It's an obviously messianic psalm. You can take a look at Psalm 69. There it says, "For my thirst they gave me vinegar to drink." That's what's meant by sour wine, vinegary type liquid. This should not be confused with the wine mixed with myrrh that Jesus refused just before he was crucified. That was offered to deaden the pain. And that was a common thing that I would assume most everyone took advantage of. Jesus did not. He knew that he was meant to suffer with a clear mind. This sour wine, this vinegar, it was there for the use of the soldiers, for one thing. Someone soaked a sponge in the liquid, stuck it on a stalk of hyssop. That's a plant. The dried, sturdy stalk of it, I would assume. And it was held up to Jesus' mouth so that some of the liquid could go into his mouth. The presence of hyssop, that would not seem to be accidental. Psalm 51:7, "Purify me with hyssop, and I shall be clean. Wash me, and I shall be whiter than snow." This seems to be yet another confirmation that Jesus had cleansed his people from their sin. But as we watch Jesus take a last drink here, we're also forcefully reminded of his humanity, are we not? His humanity. Now, this is important. John has taken great pains in this gospel to prove that Jesus was fully God. I trust we've seen that and taken that away. But he was fully man as well. It was real flesh that was torn when those nails went in. Real nerve endings sent currents of pain throughout his body. Real blood was shed. And Jesus needed the lowly substance of vinegar to relieve his seared throat. Only a true man could be accepted by the Father as our substitute. Physically, Jesus was just as we are, yet without sin. And so God was thirsty. Verse 30 ends John's account of the crucifixion. "Therefore, when Jesus had received the sour wine, he said, 'It is finished.' And he bowed his head and gave up his spirit." In Greek, this final statement, three words in English that John records, it's one word, tetelestai. Might even be worth writing down. T-E-T-E-L-E-S-T-A-I. T-E-T-E-L-E-S-T-A-I. Tetelestai. It's the exact same word that underlies "had been accomplished" in verse 28. It is the same verb that Jesus used in 17:4, back at the beginning of the time, during his prayer in the upper room, 17:4, during his prayer in the upper room, speaking of having accomplished the work that his Father had given him to do. The perfect tense is what we have here. really, it has been finished, if you want to be completely technical about it. Past action with continuing results. What fullness of meaning is contained in that one Greek word, tetelestai. That is a shout of victory, my friends. This has been a grim and heartbreaking scene, has it not? Surely the climax of all this, you know, humiliation and horror would not be an expression of triumph. And yet it is. Jesus knew that the great transaction had at last been consummated. It was done. The sin of the elect had been done away with in his body. The righteousness of his perfectly obedient life had been credited to his people. Colossians 2, 13 through 15 gives us a little of the spirit of the cry here of tetelestai. When you were dead in your transgressions and the uncircumcision of your flesh, he made you alive together with him, having forgiven us all our transgressions, having canceled out the certificate of debt consisting of decrees against us, which was hostile to us. And he has taken it out of the way, having nailed it to the cross. When he had disarmed the rulers and authorities, he made a public display of them, having triumphed over them through him. This is triumph. Oh, death, where is your victory now? For Jesus, for those in him, there's no victory now there. We are the victors. Let's be clear about the truth that this word communicates, tetelestai. Picking up on what Colossians says there about the debt, the certificate of debt. At the time of Christ, Greek was the language of commerce. We have actual receipts, you know, from the businesses of this time, how they handled transactions. And when an account had been paid in full, one word was stamped across the document. Tetelestai. How important it is for us to understand that when Jesus said, "It is finished," he meant exactly that. He didn't say, "I've done my part, and now it's up to you to take it from here. I hope you can take this all the way with your own deeds. I've done all I can do." Woe to any man that would try to add anything to the finished work of Christ. There's nothing else to do, nothing else that could be done. To say that God needs any other basis than the life and death of Christ to reconcile us with him is to contradict Jesus' own final statement on this matter, tetelestai. It's done. It's paid. There's nothing more to do. It's all been discharged. And having declared that victory, Jesus gave up his spirit. In Luke, we have his very last words, "Father, how wonderful, bearing the sin, my God," that relationship was no longer there. But now that he has accomplished what he was sent to do, Father, into thy hands I commit my spirit. This verb, gave up, could be translated delivered up. It's translated that way many times in Scripture, including in verse 16. Jesus' life was not taken from him. He handed it over to the Father voluntarily. You remember back in John 10, what did Jesus say about his life? John 10, 17 and 18. For this reason the Father loves me, because I lay down my life so that I may take it again. No one has taken it away from me, but I lay it down on my own initiative. I have authority to lay it down, and I have authority to take it up again. This commandment I received from my Father. Here we see those words fulfilled. Father, I give you my spirit. Jesus could hand over his spirit and immediately breathe his last, because his death was a matter of his own will. John has led us through some deep things. You know, preaching on these things, it's a wonderful experience. It's a tough experience. There's only so much time, and you hope that for this time, at least, the things that were needed to get out got out, and that there are other times for other wonderful thoughts and truths. Well, we've seen Jesus' concern for the needs of others, despite a colossal moment of personal crisis. So we take note of that. We've seen the divinity and the humanity of Christ displayed for us. There can be no doubt about both of those truths. But nothing speaks to the meaning of his death as does the words, "It is finished." All history before looked to that word, and all history since looks back to that word. If we're a believer, the debt has been paid. Christ's triumph over sin and death at that moment is your triumph. Do you have tetelestai stamped on your life this day? The spiritual realm can see whether that's true. Is that what's stamped on your life? It's done, it's paid, it's finished. Or do you still have a frightful, monumental, eternal bill to pay when you stand before your Creator? You will never work off that debt. I don't care what you do the rest of your whole life that you think God should like, you will never work off that debt. You will never escape that debt. That gets paid. It gets paid by Christ, or it gets paid by you. God's holy. May God graciously turn every heart here to rest in what Jesus has accomplished on behalf of sinners. Let's pray.